Good afternoon. I'm Dick Solomon, the president of the Institute of Peace. Well, I must say with this audience, a slight confession, I went to school in Boston for many years, and I always found that if I sort of slurred my last name a little bit, so it sounded like Sullivan rather than Solomon, I always got this very enthusiastic reception from the many Boston Irish. But seriously, we're delighted to be hosting this event today on a week that has tended to be known recently as St. Patrick's Week because of the many events that are held around town. I should apologize for the fact we're meeting here in a hotel rather than at the Institute, but we are in an unbelievable week of meetings. This morning, the Institute launched a major initiative on Iraq, trying to re-evaluate, take a fresh eyes look at that situation, an initiative headed by a former Secretary of State, James Baker, and Lee Hamilton. So we were up in the Congress all morning getting that initiative started. Tomorrow, midday, we're hosting the President's National Security Advisor, Steve Hadley. And a day or two later, the President of Liberia will be at our institution. So we're sort of overwhelmed with very interesting and important things going on. And this meeting today is very much a part of it. All I would say is a couple of years from now, we hope that in our new building up on the Mall, we hope that we'll be able to host this kind of an event in a much more expanded set of conference facilities that are very much a part of the permanent headquarters facility for the Institute that is part of our planning. And frankly, much of my time these days is trying to complete the fundraising that will enable us to start construction on that building just about a year from now. But let me say a few things about our interest in the situation in Northern Ireland. Our mandate from Congress is try to develop best practices and an understanding of the dynamics of conflict situations, the better to help people understand how they can deal with some of the most intractable and bitter conflicts that unfortunately continue to pose great challenges to the international community. The situation in Iraq today, of course, is a good example of such a problem. And at the Institute, we over the years have sponsored a range of studies and research activities designed to help us understand those dynamics and pull together a sense of best practices. Our Senior Fellows Program is a good example. We've supported Paul Arthur in his work on the unofficial diplomacy that surrounded the signing of the Good Friday Agreement. And we recently published John Darby's book on the effects of violence on the peace process. And we've hosted Marie Smith's work on the problems posed by militant youth in implementing a peace agreement. And as well, our grants program has provided support for a number of civil society institutions who are encouraging and supporting the work of various grassroots peacemaking initiatives in Northern Ireland, especially focused on how we deal with victimized elements of the society as a result of the conflict, how we can reach across the divide where communities still do not trust one another. So Northern Ireland peace process remains very much a matter of interest to the Institute, because it is today one of the relative success stories as we look at conflicts around the world. As a result of the agreements, we've seen a significant reduction in the level of violence, improvement in relationships all across the British Isles, and new approaches to policing the agreement. That said, of course, there are major challenges ahead, that communal divisions remain deep, and that's one aspect of the situation that as we watch efforts to deal with these communal divisions, we'll see some positive lessons learned that we can apply to a situation as we know we're going to have to deal with in the evolving situation in Iraq, just as one example. We take a great deal of interest in the current shared future process now underway in Northern Ireland, again, because we think it and hope that it will provide many positive lessons for those trying to implement peace agreements elsewhere in the world. So we welcome your interest here today and all the good thinking that will come out of the discussions here. And I'm very pleased that we have a range of very distinguished speakers from both Northern Ireland, or from Ireland and the United States. I should at least give a special welcome to my colleague and friend Mitchell Rees, who isn't here at the moment. He's trapped up on Capitol Hill with a congressional hearing. Mitchell was a very worthy successor to one of the most interesting jobs in our foreign affairs establishment, that is the director of the policy planning staff. I was privileged to hold that job during the last days of the Soviet Union, as in the late 80s the Soviet Union was coming apart. And you never know exactly what challenges you'll get in the policy planning job, but there's almost always something very interesting in that position. And the fact that Mitchell Rees remains the president's special envoy to Northern Ireland, even after his term in that particular job, is some indication of both his skills and the fact that he's still making a major contribution. We're also very pleased that our moderator today is Stephen Ferry, currently a senior fellow with us at the Institute. And I look to him to introduce our other participants today. So let me again express our appreciation for you all coming. I do apologize that I've got to go back to the office and get ready for Mr. Hadley's presentation tomorrow, but I wish you very successful discussions here today. Stephen,
thank you.
Thank you all again for coming.
Thank you very much, Dick, for coming along today during what is not only a very busy week for Irish affairs in Washington, but also a very busy week for the Institute. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Stephen Farry, but I probably know about half the people in this room already, and I'm currently a senior fellow at the Institute. Currently I'm on leave from my normal post, which is the General Secretary of the Alliance Party of Northern Ireland, so the concept of a shared future is something that's very close to my own heart. A shared future refers to the process and the goal of creating a shared and integrated society in Northern Ireland. All societies, in one way or another, have to address difference. Some multi-ethnic societies are able to remain relatively integrated. However, in other cases, difference becomes institutionalized into separation, and in some extreme cases, it breeds violence or even ethnic cleansing. Despite, or in some cases maybe because of the Good Friday Agreement, the Northern Ireland remains a deeply divided society. These divisions are along ethno-nationalist, religious and cultural lines and have been mutually reinforcing. Strong sectarian and racist attitudes remain prevalent across society, and there's a deeply ingrained pattern of segregation. While separation is generally speaking not the formal policy of the state, there is substantial duplication in the provision of goods, facilities and services by both the public and private sectors. Most notably in the field of education, 95% of Northern Ireland school children attend what is in effect a segregated school system. However, that said, there are many positive trends. Significant elements of civic society are organised on a cross-community basis. The workplace, largely through top-down regulation, is integrated. There's evidence of substantial public support for shared education, housing and leisure pursuits. But this aspiration is often frustrated, sometimes through lack of facilities, but mainly due to fears over security, both physical and cultural. In terms of identity, more and more people are casting off traditional labels and challenging the notion that Protestant must equal British, must equal Unionist, or Catholic must equal Irish, must equal Nationalist. Increasing numbers of new immigrants are coming to Northern Ireland to work, an encouraging sign of a globalising economy. The conventional wisdom was once that Northern Ireland would continually be divided into two mutually antagonistic communities, and that these divisions could at best only be managed on the basis of separate but equal provision. However, it has become increasingly recognised, both through civic society and government, that the economic, financial and personal costs of managing a divided society are unsustainable. A divided society creates major distortions within the economy. It is a major drain on public resources. It deprives many people of the opportunity to reach their full potential. The them versus us competition over control of resources and territory provides a continual source of communal tensions that can sometimes flare up. While in theory there may be a choice between trying to manage a divided community on the basis of separate but equal versus encouraging integration, in practice there is no real choice to be made. The Northern Ireland administration and the British government, which continues to govern Northern Ireland given the suspension of the political institutions, has now formally recognised the concept of a shared and integrated future for our country. At this stage, the framework is strong on vision and principles, but needs to be developed into more specific policies. The government will shortly be releasing the first of a series of shared future action plans to address the policy challenge of turning this vision into reality. The challenge goes beyond the provision of shared goods, facilities and services. It extends to ensuring the maintenance of the rule of law. It must include addressing the needs of victims and reconciliation. The task of building a shared future is not going to be easy, and there are powerful vested interests to be overcome. But ultimately, the creation of a shared future is critical to building a stable and sustainable peace. Northern Ireland has much to learn from the experiences of other societies around the world in terms of dealing with division, not least the United States. But hopefully other situations around the world can learn from the Northern Ireland experience. Community relations issues are often neglected in peacemaking, but the persistence of sectarian divisions in situations such as Bosnia and the re-emergence of sectarianism within Iraq clearly shows the need to address these type of issues. I believe our shared future process has the potential to become an invaluable example of post-conflict transformation and to contribute to the wider debates on how to address sectarian and other divisions within deeply divided societies. And on the back of this conference, we plan to produce a special report on the shared future concept. We decided to hold a conference on shared future today to try to show a different aspect of the work within the Northern Ireland peace process. We've brought along what we hope is a wide range of speakers who can provide different perspectives on the issue. Our first speaker was intended to be Mitchell Rees. Now, he's currently giving evidence, or was giving evidence, on Capitol Hill on the policing issue, and we've been informed that he's now left the Capitol and is on his way. But we'll move ahead with the rest of our speakers, with three excellent speakers from Northern Ireland. Duncan Morrow, who's the Chief Executive of the Community Relations Council. Michael Wardlow, who's the Chief Executive of the Northern Ireland Council for Integrated Education, and Nigel Hamilton, the head of the Northern Ireland Civil Service. And I'm particularly grateful for Nigel Hamilton stepping in at the last minute, because, as you know, we had planned to have the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Peter Hain, with us today, but unfortunately he was detained in London for the crucial votes on the Education Bill tonight. So with that, I'm going to now hand over to Duncan Morrow to give the first address. We'll go through each of the speakers, and at the end there will be an opportunity for questions and comments to be taken from the floor. So thank you very much, and I'll now hand over to Duncan Morrow, our first speaker. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stephen, and thank you, Richard, and the US Institute of Peace. First of all, for those of you who are not from Northern Ireland, I apologise if any of this appears to make reference to things which are too parochial. First of all, I just want to say that a shared future is at one level both just a phrase which encapsulates something about which we are automatically concerned in a post-conflict process, and a document. It is actually a government policy which is available at the back of the room. So that when we refer to this, or when I refer to it at least, it may be being referred to interchangeably between the two, and I hope that I'll try and make clear what I'm doing. Coming to Washington this year, what is remarkable to me is that anyone can still raise themselves to be interested in Northern Ireland, given the context which we are now in. It is all a bit reminiscent of the apocryphal story of the distinction between a Prussian and an Austrian during World War I, where the Prussians, raised on efficiency and outcomes, cabled that the situation is serious but not hopeless, to which the Austrians, resigned to the impossibility of order, replied, "And ours is hopeless but not serious." Comparing Northern Ireland to late Habsburg Austria, however, may be apposite. In the years leading up to World War I, the Austrian monarchy administered a perpetual political stalemate on the national question. The empire had left messy internal frontiers where people of different language and religion did not live in conveniently separate territorial units, but in a kaleidoscope of different combinations. Elections became national headcounts, and democracy a question of competing claims to be the legitimate owners and rulers of specific and overlapping pieces of territory. As a result, the monarchy continued to directly administer the Austrian portion of the empire through a bureaucratic class who developed a sense that they had no specific political purpose other than survival. So administration became the pragmatic response to the absence of a functioning democratic political order. The second point that ties us to this situation was that it was on former Habsburg territories that Woodrow Wilson, who I need to remind you was an Ulster Scot and has a homestead in Northern Ireland, applied his doctrine of national self-determination most comprehensively. With a touching faith in the power of democratic political order to create peace and freedom, which we may also know, Wilson sponsored the national dreams of the Czechs, the Poles, the Slovaks, the Romanians, and through Yugoslavia, of the Serbs. What he underestimated was the degree to which their national liberty came at the expense of the Germans, the Hungarians, the Italians, and ultimately of Croats and Slovenes. Instead of creating a democratic continent as he dreamed, Wilson's Europe became a seething hotbed of national resentment, and most of the territory of the empire had degenerated into authoritarianism within 15 years of his project. Voting without a transcendent sense of citizenship does not equate to democracy. Nationalism became the overarching theme of politics and proved incapable of incorporating others, despite the rhetoric, preferring instead to concentrate on political and territorial control. Finally, when poison took hold of Germany, the Habsburg territories became the scene of the great European catastrophe. Auschwitz, Theresienstadt, and Mauthausen were all on former Habsburg lands, as were Lidice, where an entire Czech village was massacred in revenge for the killing of Reinhard Heydrich, and Jasenovac, where Hitler's Croat puppets massacred tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of Serbs. It became, if you like, the place where nationalism became both hopeless and serious. Northern Ireland is faced with some of the same dilemmas, albeit in miniaturised form. We inherit from empire a complex demographic composition, which has crystallised as permanent political polarisation around legitimacy and nationality, and turns the theory of democratic participation and decision-making into a regular exercise in ethnic headcounting. Politics never seems to get past the founding question about Northern Ireland itself, to be or not to be. As a result, Northern Ireland has been administered for most of the last 35 years. For most of those years, a brutal proxy war was fought between paramilitaries of different sorts and low-level operations of the state, which both compromised democracy and left a legacy of killing and fear. When Alec Reid, who's a priest in Northern Ireland, who's been very heavily involved in the peace process, and recently was one of the witnesses to decommissioning by the IRA, accuses Willie Fraser, who comes from a Protestant victims group, of acting, Willie Fraser's people, of acting like Nazis when in power. And Willie Fraser insists that the IRA is in fact a genocidal conspiracy against him and his sort. We can abhor the exaggeration, but we need to recognise the underlying fears which continue to drive people to believe that peace is a pipe dream. Which takes us at last, I suppose, to a shared future. I have been exercised for some time by the absence of a question mark in this document, arguing that it confronts us with the reality that it is not a question of whether we share, but only a question of the quality of our sharing. In this forum, I want to acknowledge that it ain't necessarily so. But for us to avoid sharing requires us to contemplate our equivalent of Auschwitz, Lidice, and Srebrenica. More than political advantage is at stake in this policy. If we are not prepared to commit to a shared future, we are implicitly going down a track which has already led to expulsion and murder at local level, and bringing these things within the legitimate reach of politics in Western Europe. In this light, for me certainly, this policy, a shared future, becomes the project for Northern Ireland, not simply one among many. It is a question of a shared future or a scared future, or potentially of a shared failure. It is, if you like, the working through of a fundamental decision which still needs to be taken by sufficient numbers across the political spectrum, that a peaceful, just and truthful society cannot be achieved except through a building down of enmity and a political choice to welcome rather than to resist the other, by which I mean an irrevocable decision to enter into a political project in which we are committed to making space for the others and to allowing hybrids to emerge. This is, of course, the challenge of our time beyond Northern Ireland. Events in Denmark, Holland and France have shown the crisis of social cohesion across Europe, and the discovery that the London bombers last July were homegrown has been a profound shock to Britain. Yesterday's Irish Times carried an editorial in which they estimated that there are, unofficially, and I have no other basis except the Irish Times, 750,000 foreign workers in the 26 counties at this moment out of a population of about 4 million. That makes Ireland the fastest diversifying society in the world. A pure backward-looking territorial nationalism can only deal with the scale of this challenge through violence. A romantic, naive democracy which does not recognise the challenge to the fundamental contract underlying the state which such a change poses is, however, not its opposite but its twin, provoking the very spectre which it abhors. What all of this requires is a seriousness of purpose about sharing, relationship and citizenship. Above all, it requires leaders and agents, not just policies and documents. At a recent conference in Enniskillen, Melanie Verwoerd, former South African ambassador to Ireland, commented that Mandela's great achievement was to make people believe that peace was possible. The question for us is who steps up to the plate of a shared future? At the moment, the absence of political drive behind a shared future can only be put down to ambivalence. We have, it seems, agreed in Northern Ireland after 35 years to stop, but not to share. Or at least, we are not prepared or able to take the very hard decisions. Although, for me, there really only are two left. Firstly, that violence outside the law is over, credibly and permanently, which means the effective end to paramilitary organisations and their rhetoric of community defence. And secondly, that the notion of a political community which draws support only from one side of that community is equally over for good, both in intention and fact. The difficulties do not lie only in a failure to generate devolution, although they are clearly manifest there, but also in the unwillingness of the British and Irish governments to take any further responsibilities in Northern Ireland. Expecting Northern Ireland's fearful communities to believe in the bona fides of their enemies has echoes of Turkey's voting for Christmas. In the end, Northern Ireland is irreducibly part of a wider British-Irish picture in which the legacy of colony and empire and of the violent response to it have left the six counties of the north as a giant unresolved interface, while the rest of the formerly active participants have walked off. What is required in both London and Dublin is increased clarity that the unself-conscious and uncontested Britishness of or Irishness that is now achieved on the rest of these of our islands is not really achievable in Northern Ireland under any jurisdiction without a degree of violence which cannot be contemplated while remaining democratic. What Britain and Ireland have done well is find alternatives to internationalised territorial conflict. However, this has, from within Northern Ireland, tended to look more like a desire to abandon rather than an active commitment to co-produce shared solutions on the ground. Without clear permission and protection from Britain and Ireland, and where possible from Europe and America, the fears of Northern Ireland will almost certainly preclude the commitment to sharing and engagement that is required. Specifically, it is time for both governments and their international allies to underline that the only game in town is the search for a shared future and its realisation in practice. At one level, this is a given, but it has been weak and faltering, and too often appears to compete with short-term political imperative to be rid of the problem. Most problematically, it has not yet shaped the policy choices sufficiently for fear, it appears, of upsetting shorter-term projects. To be clear, in my view, devolution, which fudges the issue of our common predicament and our interdependence, is doomed. Conceptually, at least, the notion of a common and shared future, based on mutual recognition as citizens and equality and human rights for all, comes prior to institutional design. So we need clear and unambiguous leadership from the international sponsors of the peace process, which has given such legitimacy to the whole task in the past. We also need clarity about the primacy of the rule of law. By that I mean not just law and order, but also the reality of equality and human rights and of access to political participation. Homeland security was called in Northern Ireland special powers, but it turned into an over-reliance on the knowledge, supposedly, of intelligence, a willingness to go beyond the law to save the law, and the establishment of systems of suspicion in relation to certain types of citizen. It was tried in Northern Ireland, and it did not work. It didn't work because it eroded the fundamental distinction between force and violence, without which all legitimacy for the state is lost. It compromised the police, it tarnished the state, and it embedded alienation. Most importantly, and this is increasingly clear across the globe, it was visible as violence to a huge international audience and acted as the key justifying evidence for the legitimacy of terror. Also, in the Irish case, it legitimated terror for many Americans. But there is a security dimension to this as well. The Northern Ireland conflict has been managed by allowing large parts of the territory to be all but officially designated as Protestant or Catholic, creating inordinate problems about housing people without creating new imbalances in land and ownership. The Housing Authority produces leaflets which proclaim the right to live in a single identity community, which is in practice a right to exclude other citizens on the basis of their origins or perceived political affiliations. And in effect, this right is maintained by common sense, you'd be mad to live there, and by paramilitary control through threat and intimidation. This has to stop. The housing problem is simultaneously a law and order and rule of law and policing problem. It is unfair to target the housing authorities demanding change, lest we're also willing to look at what safe, integrated public housing space requires, and it requires a rule of law, equal access by need, no guarantee of owning any territory according to origin, and the writ of human rights for everyone. If this can't be turned around instantly, it's critical that government integrate it into all regeneration plans for the future, at least from now on. There can be no question of Protestant or Catholic areas in perpetuity, except as a temporary reflection of current patterns and not a claim to permanent territorial ownership. There are a series of key redevelopment plans in Belfast, Derry, Londonderry, and in rural areas, all of which need to factor this in up front. In all of this, local government, as the most pragmatic and still elected level of government, has a critical civic leadership function. Another public policy, the review of public administration, for my money, must ensure in an explicit way that services and government is open, that power is clearly shared, and that flags and emblems do not obstruct civic cooperation. All of these are real, current, practical issues. The great question mark hanging over a shared future, leaving aside political difficulties, is a nagging sense that there has been a failure to get real interdepartmental government buy-in. As we move from policy to implementation, if this is a gap, it will become ever more glaring. Housing, local government and regeneration are critical, as too is the consistent voice of business arguing for stability and free labour markets. Equally important, for example, is education. Until now, integration has been led by parental initiative and softer interventions with other schools. It strikes me that economics and politics have conspired to change this agenda somewhat. The first step that needs to be taken is in announcing that education for a diverse society needs to be defined as a purpose of education across Northern Ireland and integrated into the curriculum, structure and calendar of every child at each appropriate level. The second is the opportunities which have now emerged for collaboration, including shared resources, buildings and institutions. It is absolutely essential that the priority of a shared future shines through the changes in education at the beginning and at the end. A generic commitment to collaboration cannot be allowed to disguise the imperative that some of this collaboration has to be intersectoral. What becomes clear is that an unambiguous decision to share this future in Northern Ireland is a profound political choice with ramifications for the entire system. Perhaps this is the Ulsterman's reason why it is instinctively resisted. While we need to accept this and find ways to take practical steps which generate confidence rather than provoke immediate fears, the degree of investment in managed segregation and in cultural antagonism means that sometimes the hard decisions can't be avoided and the signals have to be given and political battles may have to be fought and won. I am not myself an undiluted advocate either of consociation or of full integration. It strikes me that the precise balance to be struck between these things can be allowed to be negotiated as long as it is within a framework that recognises common humanity rather than the framework which emphasises eternal enmity. What Northern Ireland has had is the resources and international support to indulge in a long-term experiment towards this end. What it also shows is that a stable peace requires clear moral leadership, the establishment of legitimacy around force and the delegitimisation of all other violence, and clear rules to guarantee human rights and equality. Beyond that, it requires a commitment to detailed intervention so that there is a consistency of public policy across the board, to government action and to the long term. So as we go more and more global, it is clear that defeating the enemy at the cost of creating a desert or a vacuum does not work as a mechanism for security. Battlefield victory does not deliver security. The framework of a shared future offers a potential coherence to policy and action which over time could become the new common sense. But it requires a priority from politics and government which goes beyond the simple notion that community relations is the soft stuff of nice people talking to nice people about nice things, the cucumber sandwiches of policy set against the hard stuff of economics. In fact, it is not soft and hard, it is the software, without which the hardware is only a pile of unwanted junk. Perhaps Northern Ireland still might have something to share with the rest of the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Duncan. And Duncan is renowned for being a great challenger of the conventional wisdoms in Northern Ireland. So he's certainly a great servant to trying to produce this shared future that is so elusive for us. It's now my great pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker for today's session. That is the Honourable Mitchell Rees. The United States has taken a very strong interest in the affairs of Northern Ireland, and if truth be told, somewhat out of proportion to maybe our global significance. The current Bush administration has been very ably served by its special envoys, not least the current occupant of that post, Mitchell himself. Mitchell has spoken out very clearly and consistently on two issues in particular, first being policing and the second that of a shared future, where he's been a very strong advocate of that course of action. In that role, he's been ably served by successive US consuls based in Belfast, including Dean Pittman, the current occupant, who's also here today with us. As well as his diplomatic postings, Mitchell also leads a very busy academic life and at present is the Vice Provost of International Affairs at the College of William and Mary. And for most students of Irish history, King William played a very prominent role. So we're looking forward with great interest to what Mitchell has to say to us today, and we're very grateful for him taking time out of his extremely busy schedule this week, and not least today, to come along to address us this afternoon. So thank you very much, and the floor is Mitchell's.
First of all, let me apologize for being late this afternoon. One of the few unbreakable rules in Washington is that you never walk out on a congressional hearing when you're testifying. So I had to stay as long as they wanted to ask me questions, but I'm afraid also I have to compound my being late by saying that I have to leave at 5:30 this afternoon also. But I hope in no way that clouds what I want to say today, or what I think is a long-standing and emphatic commitment by this administration and by all American administrations for a shared future in Northern Ireland. I particularly want to thank Stephen for organizing the conference today, and I'm very happy to have shared this platform today with Duncan, Michael, and Nigel, although there were moments when Duncan was talking, I wasn't sure he was going to let anybody else share today. As I said, the United States, both the administration and the American people, strongly support greater integration in Northern Ireland. We support it because we know that it holds out the promise of putting a 300-year-old conflict behind us once and for all by getting at differences and divisions that are the root of the problem. And we support it because we bring to this issue our experience as Americans. And we know that integration is simply better than segregation. Sometimes I hear from individuals in Northern Ireland that they need to defend the practice of segregation, saying that two systems, one for Catholics, one for Protestants, are necessary because you don't realize how hard it is to integrate. And I think the response to that, the only response that any American can give, is that, yes, we do know, because our own history is colored by a segregated past. And we do know that as hard as it is to try to overcome the legacy and the traditions of that segregation, it's absolutely essential for a better future. And we know that it's worth the effort in the long run. We know that children studying together and playing and going to school together, growing up together, is really the best investment that you can make for the future so that they don't meet people from other traditions for the first time in the workplace, if they meet them at all. We know that it doesn't make sense economically for there to be parallel systems. Separate but equal was the euphemism used here, but it really never was equal, and it certainly wasn't cost-effective. And again, there is only one way forward for people in the North. Now, it may have been an argument that had some currency among some people in the past that segregation at least was necessary as a temporary measure. But I think that where we are now in the peace process, where we are 8 years on from the Good Friday Agreement, the enormous progress that has been made, not to gainsay the progress that still needs to be made, but the enormous progress that has been made is really the best argument possible for integration. There are people who are in this room who are sharing this platform with me who are in the trenches every day trying to build a better society in Northern Ireland. And as I said, everything that I can do, everything that the consulate in Belfast under the able leadership of Dean Pittman can do, we will do to support these efforts. I'm also particularly proud that so many Americans, most especially Irish Americans, have donated their time, their efforts, and a significant part of their bank accounts to helping the integrated education movement in Northern Ireland. But I think, as Duncan said, it's high time that these acts by private individuals, these acts of private generosity, be overtaken by a greater institutional commitment on the part of the local government to assume the responsibility for integrated education. Private giving can make a difference, and it has in Northern Ireland, but it is no substitute for an institutional commitment to a shared future. Now, all Americans, I think, should be proud of the fact that their government is not only supporting integrated education, but also a host of other measures to trying to build bridges between the two traditions in the North. This involves support for truth and reconciliation processes, a commitment that policing should serve all communities, regardless of your tradition. working with the private sector to come up with creative ideas for community programming directed at young children like Sesame Street and other similar projects, and supporting the International Fund for Ireland and the excellent work they do across the board, but especially in the interface communities. Now, we're delighted that the UK government has adopted Shared Future as a policy goal. It wasn't always obvious, to be frank, that this would have been the outcome. Just last week, Secretary of State Peter Hain delivered an important speech on education in Northern Ireland entitled Securing Our Future. In it, he called for a fundamental review with radical thinking on the best way forward. I hope that integrated education will emerge from this review with the strong institutional support that it deserves. Now, to the extent that American voices help create the momentum and sustain the momentum for this vision, we share in celebrating this outcome and hope to remain partners with all the people of Northern Ireland in tackling the challenges that lay ahead. I'd like to end there, and I think, Stephen, you
sure.
We're going to lay it open to take any questions.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mitchell. And the other speakers are very, very kindly agreed, given the time constraints upon Mitchell Rees, that we can take some questions from the floor now. I think we have a couple of roving microphones. So if you want to ask a question, just please raise your hand and someone will come to you as quickly as possible.
I think I'll stay at the podium so I can be a moving target rather than sitting down.
Okay.
Maybe there's complete consensus.
Sure. Well, first of all, but could I ask you, do you think that the American experience with dealing with segregated schools has many lessons to teach Northern Ireland?
Well, I think that we've seen through our own history, one that I think we're not particularly proud of, that separate but equal really is nothing that really satisfies the equality side of that phrase. Inherently separate is unequal because it denies individuals the opportunity to meet with people that are different than themselves. And our country is nothing if it's not based on respect for diversity and different traditions. After all, aside from Native Americans, we all ended up coming from other places. And we understand, I think better than most countries, how very difficult it is to try to forge one country out of many different elements. But again, with education, with segregated laws, with a whole variety of institutional mechanisms that divided us from each other, ultimately it was unsustainable. And a great voice rose up, especially in the 1960s with the civil rights movement, that was heard around the world. And I think that Northern Ireland has that same opportunity. I think it's come a long way in the last few years. I think, as Duncan and others have pointed out, it still has some way to go.
Sure. Great, thanks. With some questions, some hands coming up now. First of all, over here. And can I ask everyone just to state their name and affiliation for our record, given that we're taping today's event? Okay, so just a question over there, if we can get a mic.
My name is Dennis Staunton from the Irish Times. Yes. Could I ask you two questions? One, a general question, which is there a contradiction or a conflict between the fact that the Good Friday Agreement essentially for political purposes demands that people state a particular affiliation, between that element of the agreement and what you're trying to do in terms of a shared future? And secondly, with regard to policing, you were speaking about that earlier today. How urgent is it that Sinn Féin should move, and within what kind of timescale do you think that that this ought to take place or has to take place?
Well, I think that to answer the second question first, I think that the people who live in these communities would like to have decent policing yesterday and don't feel that they should wait, that they need to wait any further. Now, obviously, for the political party involved, it's not that simple. But again, if the focus is on the people who actually live in these Republican and nationalist communities, as I think it should be, they're not being well served right now. And they're living a ghettoized existence. They're not being treated equally. And I think everybody who has looked at this problem realizes that this is one of the great hurdles and challenges that faces us going forward. So I think all of us who are involved in this issue on the American side would like this issue to be solved as soon as possible.
Okay.
The first question.
Duncan, you're probably better positioned to answer that first one than I am.
Okay, we're
going to bat it over to Duncan.
We'll park that one for later, okay, Dennis? Okay, we have a question at the back.
Timothy Curry from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. One of the questions that I had is that in looking at the cross-community outreach that goes on in Northern Ireland or even at Project Children or various other programs, most of the students or the individuals or families that are part of that are not the people you need to reach. The people you need to reach are the people in the entrenched communities in certain areas of North Belfast or East or West or various other areas who are not going to participate in those things. And the U.S. has a particular experience, especially in, you know, I come from Boston, and one only has to look at the forced busing system where we tried to integrate the schools to get better understandings. How do we make the education process or the integration process something that reaches down into the communities that truly need it? And how do we also make sure that the people who do take part in it, if it is voluntary, is not just a veneer of, you know, not really addressing the problem?
Sure. Now, I come from Boston, too. You don't sound like you come from Boston, I got to tell you. Nigel and I were actually discussing this morning, and maybe, Nigel, you might want to address how do you get these pockets of real poverty or real resistance to some of the progress that's being made?
I think part of the problem that we face is simply the culture that exists in these communities. And I say that as someone who lived in North Belfast for 27 years and therefore believe I have some understanding of what's happening. Because if you take, for example, areas around the Shankill in North Belfast, there are few role models in education. The role models are the paramilitaries and the criminals. If I may, I tell you a story of a friend of mine who's a principal of a school in there. I was telling Mitchell this morning, a primary school, who met two of her former pupils who are now 14-year-olds. And when she asked them what their ambition was, they said to be former prisoners. Because it's the former prisoners who are the role models in terms of their gravitas and their influence in the areas. So I think there's a real issue, the real issue for us all, that is everybody in the public sector, government, the education folk, the leadership in the community, elected representatives, parents. We've got to try over a period of time, and this isn't a short-term thing, this has got to be a sustained effort over a period of time to actually rebuild the value in education, to rebuild a situation where the young folk realise that it's education through skills, through employment, which is actually the way to prosperity. That's not easy. And I don't pretend that for one moment that it's easy. And that's why I think we need a long-term sustained application with particular interventions into those areas.
Okay. Thanks, Nigel. I think we have a question in the middle here.
Hi, Mitchell. You have had the pleasure of being engaged for a little while now in Northern Ireland Affairs. I'm just wondering, I'm interested in the issue of capacity of the community, the full community, to actually engage with a new emphasis now on the policy. That having been cleared, even though it took far too much time, I think. But in your perception over your time there, have you noticed a change in attitudes which would give us some confidence that we have the capacity right throughout civic society to actually embrace the policy?
Yes, as I've said before, if you're not optimistic, you're probably in the wrong line of business for doing what I'm doing. But Dennis, it's not just sort of false hope here. I think that there are some legitimate reasons for why one should be confident that there is this capacity in Northern Ireland. And I want to reassure people that Dennis didn't set me up for what I'm about to say next, but one reason is because of IFI's new emphasis and the leadership that Dennis has shown there. So I think that that's been a change that, again, indicates that a shared future agenda is going to have some rate of success. The conversation I had with Nigel and Tim Lustey this morning, talking about all the changes that are in train now under Peter Hain's leadership, how they want to move forward and not wait for the assembly to be restored necessarily, but rather go forward before that time to try to bring important changes to that community. The ongoing effort of American foundations like Atlantic Philanthropies, the American Ireland Fund, British groups like the Prince's Trust, all of these people now have learned a little bit. We've gone up the learning curve, and we know how to focus on some of the core issues that remain. And partly it's because a lot of the underbrush has been cleared out of the way. There has been success. Unemployment is relatively low. We can identify where the main obstacles remain. And so given all that, I am pretty confident that there is the capacity there. There certainly appears to be increasing will now to go along with that capacity, and so I think that there's a real chance of success.
Okay, well, question at the front here. One more. That's the final question to Mitchell, and then we'll move on to Michael Wardlow. Okay, just wait for the mic. Thanks.
Thank you. John Ungerleiter from the School for International Training in Vermont, and we run youth dialogue programs for Northern Irish kids. But I'm just wondering how you see the U.S. role, your role. I mean, the preceding Mitchell, George, had a central role, but what's the role of your office? What's the appropriate role? Is it accelerating, is it moving back?
Well, I think, you kind of raised the bar at an insurmountably high level by mentioning that Senator Mitchell was my predecessor, because it's impossible, I think, for anyone to really duplicate the enormous accomplishment that he engineered with the Good Friday Agreement. And I, after having a little bit of exposure these past few years to the political leadership in Northern Ireland, I really stand in awe of how he was able to accomplish this. But I think that subsequent to Senator Mitchell, the role for the United States is pretty well defined, and it's been carried out, I think, by all of my predecessors as well, which is to try to offer fresh thinking, new ideas to all the political parties, to give them encouragement, to sometimes provide a little bit more distance and a little bit more objective view to some of the issues that are taking place, to think of alternative ways to go forward, to leverage the immense reservoir of goodwill and interest by Americans, especially Irish Americans, and bring that to bear on some of the issues that are there. And I will just finish by saying that in addition to being professionally rewarding, I just find this work so personally so rewarding because of the so many remarkable people that I've met in Ireland, North and South. I really consider it a privilege to have this job. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much to Mitchell for answering those questions and also for his opening remarks. We wish him well in his continued endeavours to bring the US influence to bear upon our process. Can I ask Michael Wardlow from the Northern Ireland Council for Integrated Education to come to the podium to give his opening remarks? And integrated education has been something that's very much in the news in Northern Ireland over the past number of weeks, and hopefully Michael can outline some of the wider context of that. Thanks, Michael.
Just want to thank Richard and Stephen for the invite to come to the USIP and to talk to you. I know probably about a third of you here because I think you've all come over in the same plane. And it's great just to talk for a little bit about education. And I make no apologies for talking about education because at the minute there's a time of huge educational change in Northern Ireland. We're going through the review of public administration, which will change the face of education as one of the areas of public administration. We're going through a review of post-primary provision in Northern Ireland. We're looking at a change in the curriculum in Northern Ireland. And Peter Hain has just announced a review of the whole of the educational service to try to find out why we're not getting, quote, the bang for buck coming out the other end. And he did say in a speech just last week that he wants integrated education to be at the core of that, as it is influential and seminal as part of the peace-building process. So I look forward to engaging with this over the next 6 months. I'm also interested to talk about education because you can't talk about education and not get passionate. W.B. Yeats said that education is not the filling of a pail, it's the lighting of a candle, the lighting of a fire. And those of you who have gone through education and had a good experience, you remember that teacher who commended you for what you did well and forgot the things you didn't do so bad or didn't do so well. I mean, I have a friend who's 47. He has never sung a note in his life. After the age of 7, when a teacher put her hand on his shoulder and said, "If I were you, I would mime." Because that child was told, "You cannot and will never ever sing." So, in terms of education, I genuinely believe that education has the power to inspire, inform, mold, change. It has the power to give young people a lifelong passion for lifelong learning. And if education is about anything, it's done in the body corporate. It's done collegiately. You do not learn in isolation. You learn by example. You learn from watching your teacher. You learn from your family and your community. You learn from your church. You learn from your peer group. You learn from your teacher and from books. You learn from the internet and new IT technological developments that there have been. But ultimately, this is something that happens in a context. And in a divided society, if your educational experience is segregated, you are not being offered the same educational opportunity as those who share together at the tender age of 3.5 in preschool. Education also has the power to divide societies. And I've had the privilege of working in East Africa, in Uganda after Amin, working in Armenia, and I've seen the results of the genocide, working in Middle Europe after communism, and recently visiting Auschwitz and seeing that in our own generation, education for bad can also work and can form people and allow people to characterize others and demonize them because they've never met them. And then when you meet them and they say, "Oh, you don't have your eyes closer together. You don't have a pointy head. You don't say things differently, process. And all the shibboleths and all the myths and all the things that become, if you like, received wisdom because they're never challenged. So I believe passionately that education should be rightly at the heart of shared future, because it's at the heart of our children, it's the heart of our families, it's the heart of our future. It provides young people who will go into the workplace, who I hope will stay in Northern Ireland or in Ireland, because when I started youth work 35 years ago, we were losing 30,000 young people every year. A sign of a mature society is we import young people, not export them. And we need to start learning. We're beginning to have incomers from Portugal, from Middle Europe, from Africa and from Asia. We are fast becoming a rainbow society, and we haven't come to terms with our own differences. How on earth are we going to come to the terms of the racial differences that are going to face us? Now, in this context, Northern Ireland education system is unique. We've roughly 250,000 young people. And those 250,000 young people are educated in roughly 1,300 schools. 100 of those schools are nurseries where children from the age of 3, 3.5 are educated. Now, I would have to say that until recently, nursery education was fairly well mixed. But because of, bizarrely, the funding coming from Europe, nursery education is now quite divided. We then have a series of special schools for children with special needs, among the most integrated of all our schools, 45 of them. Bizarrely, they're not allowed to change their status to integrated. The law doesn't allow it. The law doesn't allow nursery schools to become integrated schools formally either, for some bizarre reason. We then have another 900 primary or elementary schools and roughly 2,500 colleges. And in the main, that education service is divided into 7. In a country as small as ours, 1.6 million, 250,000 children, we divide it up 7 ways. Why? Because we are predicated on parental choice, so-called. Parental choice for segregated schools, that is. Because in the last 7 years, I've turned away 5,000 young people from integrated schools. This year, I turned 500 away. And last week, bizarrely, during Integrated Week, the Minister of Education turned down proposals from 4 parent groups and told them, "No, you go back into segregated schools, you can't have integrated schools." 2 days earlier, £350 million was granted to mostly segregated schools. Now, I find that very hard to work out if what we're saying is education together for those who want it should be part of this shared future. We are not asking for desegregation. We're not asking for schools to give up their Catholics and Protestant and come together in some sort of blancmange in the middle. We're actually saying for where parents want it, this should be facilitated, because to run parallel services, quote, is morally and financially unsustainable. That's the government's own policy framework document. The Alliance Party worked out it roughly costs 8% of what money comes into Northern Ireland to subsidise a divided system, about £1 billion. Now, that is going through a government statistical review at the minute to see if it actually measures up. But let's just say it's roughly a billion. That's the cost to maintain segregation. Now, some people say, well, we don't really need integrated schools because since 1921, we've lots and lots of schools that actually have a healthy mix. Factually incorrect. In order for an integrated school to be established, parents have to have 30% of those from the other tradition in their doors. Lots of people think, oh, well, that's fine. We've got lots of them. We've grown them organically since 1921 when the state was set up. Can I tell you there are only 12 schools in the whole of Northern Ireland, apart from integrated schools, that organically have grown to 30%? Okay, let's drop the bar to 10%. Can I tell you there are only 36 schools that actually have 10% or more of the minority tradition in them? So organic or integration by osmosis demonstrably does not work. Now, one of my colleagues from Boston said at the back here, what about the quality of the education? Integrated schools are all ability schools. And the gold standard for what are 16-year-old exams, the GCSEs, one of our all-ability colleges this year that does not select an academic ability achieved 75% grades A to C, which is just below the bottom-scoring grammar school. You do not need to sell out on potential or academic ability because you bring children into the school on the whole range of academic ability. In terms of outreaching to those difficult areas, maybe I picked you up wrong, but this is not the problem of the interfaces. Sectarianism does not breed alone in socially deprived areas. It sits at the ghost of golf club tables. It is in polite society when we fail to mention the unmentionable at the table. We don't talk about it here, as Seamus Heaney said. I would suggest to you that probably a bit like a lava flow, it's onto the surface and suddenly it hits a crack and it comes up and you find the lava there, but the pressure was here. In some of those very difficult socially disadvantaged communities, you will find community cohesion breaks down. But that is not as a direct consequence of sectarianism being bred there only. We are all in our hearts sectarian. We are all in our hearts prejudiced. The difficulty is when we don't meet the other. Let me tell you a story. A young boy, 18, brought up in inner city Belfast in a working class area, who met his first Catholic when he was 18 years old. That was my brother. He met his first Catholic. Sounds like a dog or an animal or something. I met my first Catholic or Protestant, read it across, at the age of 18 at Queen's University. If he'd gone to teacher training college, he would have had much less a chance because our teacher training is also segregated. Now, all I'm trying to say today, I guess, is that if Shared Future is about anything, it's saying what we should do is allow parents who want their children to be educated together to have that opportunity. Hazelwood College and Hazelwood Primary School sit at the top and bottom of one of the most difficult areas of interface in Belfast, and we've an integrated school in both, turning children away. Integrated schools do grow in areas of community deprivation. This is not simply middle-class children. One child in four in an integrated school gets free meals because they're on benefit. Now, there's a lot of myths out there that it's middle-class. Those children will be like that anyway. But I'm suggesting to you that is not the case. Try telling that to 600 parents last year whose children did not get into integrated schools. Why do I believe in it? Because research is proving it. Paul Connolly, a friend of mine from Queens, recently carried out research to show that at the age of 3.5, children begin to demonstrate preference that becomes prejudice, that becomes sectarianism by the time they're 6, when 1 in 6 demonstrates sectarianism through an unsolicited remark about the other community. What happens between the age of 3.5 and 6? They go to school. So something is happening. Now, this is not saying segregated schools create in themselves sectarianism. That's too simple and too glib. What it is saying is that something is happening in the psyche when young people mix with their own single community and they don't know about the other one except by default and myth and mystery. And that grows until the age of 18 when they meet the first one, they realise it's all been a pipe dream. Yes, of course, they've got differences, but they want to be educated for jobs. They want to live in a Northern Ireland or a north of Ireland that actually is doing something positive for the world. So I want to challenge some of the myths that there are around, but I want more importantly to encourage you. 62% of people who have responded to Life and Times surveys since the 1960s, before the Troubles, want mixed schools. Research that we carried out 2 years ago proved that 82% of people want mixed schools. And research that was carried out this year demonstrated that young people coming through the integrated sector are creating a middle ground where they're less likely to have fixed identities going through life, recognizing that identity is fluid. I am a husband, I'm a brother, I'm a father, and I'm my own individual. Four different identities that at any one time are not conflicting with each other, but come together and serve each other. We need to be looking at how we see identity in Northern Ireland. I would suggest to you school is one place that we can help young people begin to experiment. So, finally, what can we do about all of this? The government has a shared future policy that says we need to have sharing preferenced over separation. I would like to see that carried through into the educational service, where it becomes government policy, not simply to encourage and facilitate through our own good offices, but actually to say, why don't you go into local communities and ask people what sort of school they want? Why don't we incentivise sharing? We are not for a minute, those of us who support integrated education, saying there's a one-size-fits-all. There are communities in Belfast that are single identity, can never have an integrated school. It doesn't mean they can't have an integrated experience. So what we're trying to do, and through the benefit of money that came from the International Fund from Ireland, we're looking at integrating education. We're looking at schools that come from single identity to try to help them look at diversity. How even in that single identity background can they begin to open up to others? The Catholic Church recently has said Catholic schools are not schools for Catholics. I begin to see movement. I begin to see people realising that to have young people together, there's not a problem in it. You don't catch something off somebody else because they happen to be of a different tradition. One of the big problems has been mixed marriages. Where else in the world would two white Anglo-Saxon, Protestant and Catholic, both Christians, one male, one female, being married be called a mixed marriage? And yet it is. And there's been a fear from churches and some political groups as well that maybe that's a danger. Well, maybe we need to grow up and we need to look at the rainbow that we're trying to create. A rainbow sits together simply because the colours, they merge into each other, but they don't lose their own individual identity. Some of the most the strongest identities I've ever met is in young people within our integrated sector. So, incentivise sharing. Look at rationalisation. We have 50,000 spare places in Northern Ireland. Can I tell you, they didn't creep up overnight. We didn't turn around one day and go, goodness, where did they come from? We should have been planning for 15 years for this. We now have an opportunity, and I have 1 minute left, 2 minutes, and I'm not going to take them.
Good.
Good. I'm finishing by saying, it seems to me we're not asking people to create something new here. We're asking that a commitment go forward to really building a shared future that says if separation, if quality and difference are something that we want to celebrate, not something that we should be afraid of. One place that that can happen is in an integrated school that's a safe place, or a school that opens and validates difference. Not necessarily a formally integrated school, but a school whose governance, curriculum, teachers and ancillary staff all embrace difference as something to be celebrated and not something to be relegated. I'll finish with a quotation from Kofi Annan. None of us is born intolerant of those who differ from us. Intolerance is taught and can be untaught, though often with great difficulty. But in this area, as others, prevention is far preferable than cure. We must work to prevent intolerance from taking hold in the next generation. We must build on the open-mindedness of young people and ensure their minds remain open. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael, for that very interesting set of comments upon integrated education, and certainly it's something that strikes a lot of Americans as being one of the most surprising aspects of Northern Ireland as the shape of our education system. It's now my great pleasure to call upon Nigel Hamilton, who's the head of the Northern Ireland Civil Service. And Nigel is a very important person, and certainly given the absence of devolution, Nigel effectively runs Northern Ireland. I can also, while Nigel's preparing is to take the podium, also thank the Northern Ireland Bureau, which is essentially the Northern Ireland Civil Service mini-embassy in Washington, for providing the documentation today, and thank Tim Lossley, the director of that, for bringing those along, and also for his help in putting this together. So, Nigel, can I ask you to give your remarks? Thanks.
Thank you very much indeed, Stephen. For those of you who watch certain programmes on Ulster Television, this is me. It's not a cardboard cutout. It's my pleasure today to give the speech on behalf of government and behalf of Peter Hain. As you said, Stephen, he's in the air at the moment. And what I'd like to do very briefly is just to outline government's vision for the shared future of Northern Ireland, and also then reference some important underlying principles which I think are very important as we drive forward the policy agenda. Government's vision, a future of Northern Ireland that is peaceful, inclusive, prosperous, stable, and a fair society firmly founded on the achievement of reconciliation, tolerance, and mutual trust, all based around good relationships. And the aim of shared future, i.e. the document, is the establishment over time of a normal civic society in which all individuals are considered as equals, where differences are resolved through dialogue, yes, in the public sphere, and where all people are treated impartially, where there's equity, respect for diversity, and a recognition of our interdependence. In a society like Northern Ireland, where these have become deeply entrenched into communal division, the challenge is all the greater. But as someone made reference earlier, we're not just talking about two communities, because of course we now have in Northern Ireland a growing sector, particularly from the migrant workers coming from Eastern Europe. I spent a fortnight ago in Dungannon, one of the district council towns, where 10% of the population is now migrant workers from outside Northern Ireland. And interestingly, the unemployment levels are 2.2%, because what's happening is that the incoming workers are driving the economy, particularly in the agri-food industry. But the downside of all of this is that our public policy hasn't yet caught up in terms of issues around housing, access to health services, and employment. But let's recognise that multi-ethnic societies that work well teach us specific lessons as well. They recognise that the complex makeup of each individual is what gives us our unique identity, rather than the latter being a blunt label attached to whole groups. Societies such as the one we want to establish, though never devoid of tension, can stay integrated. They can have viable democratic structures which put a premium on dialogue. Northern Ireland is a society where, as Mitchell reminded us earlier, violence, thankfully, is not anything in the scale that it once was, but criminality still exists and pervades our communities. Sectarianism and, more recently, unfortunately, racism are still too evident, and so both governments have committed themselves to the early restoration of the devolved institutions. But the Secretary of State has also said that, irrespective of progress in that, he wants to press ahead with a shared future, because it's a major policy priority for government, one which promotes sharing over separation. An integrated or a more shared society, which is the goal, is at ease with wide individual diversity, from which dynamism and vitality stem. It's held together by a willingness to engage in dialogue on a basis of equality, and by a commitment to the common good, by a culture of tolerance. The Belfast Agreement had as its vision, and I quote, the achievement of reconciliation, tolerance, and mutual trust, and the protection and vindication of the human rights of all. And the section on reconciliation and victims said more specifically, and I quote, an essential aspect of the reconciliation process is the promotion of a culture of tolerance at every level of society. To me, three key principles flow from that and from the wider international debate on multiculturalism. Firstly, everyone in Northern Ireland deserves to be treated as an individual, equal with every other person. Secondly, each of us must recognise our common humanity rather than engaging in a perpetual and sterile battle for ethnic power. And thirdly, the state must be neutral between competing cultural claims, as it says in Shared Future. Promotion of a culture of tolerance at every level and encouragement of shared education, shared housing, shared space and other public services. And Shared Future is the attempt to turn that vision into difficult but achievable aims and objectives. It's about creating a new common sense. It's about the transformation from conflict, which has already commenced. But let's be realistic. Conflict and violence have left a profound legacy, not just for those who've suffered, directly and indirectly, as victims and survivors, but in the sheer geometry of the relationship with our neighbours, both within and between communities. Time is needed to mend relationships, to heal wounds, to repair fractured communities. But let's be clear too that intolerance, antagonism, sectarianism and racism have no place in Northern Ireland or any other society. It was Maya Angelou who in her poem On the Pulse of Morning said, "Human beings are more alike than they are unalike." The same is true of Northern Ireland. They must have a shared future. How do we share that future, politically and as a wider community, requires dialogue. It requires accommodation. It requires us to work together. And good relationships and improved community relations will impact on all our areas of policy. And if, in response to Duncan, there isn't that cohesion in policy, then I will accept responsibility as well, because I will be chairing a panel representing departments and beyond in all of those sectors. But it does impact on policing, community safety, schooling, as we've heard from Michael and others, housing, health, urban and renewal, culture and arts, and how our workplaces function. This isn't easy. Let me just give two examples, and I want to, when Hugh Ord's here, I also want to commend the organisations which, for example, in Lower Shankill and in East Belfast, have worked together, the City Council, the Road Service and PSNI, to remove the graffiti on the walls, to replace the paramilitary graffiti with C.S. Lewis, to remove miles of red, white and blue painted curbstones on parts of that community. That requires coordination. That requires the various organisations to come together to do that. And that, applied at a regional level and applied across the policy areas, will have implications for us all. Moving to a more tolerant, pluralist and more shared society won't happen overnight. There's no magic ointment that can be applied or pill that you can take. Because building trust and confidence, developing social capital and tackling sectarianism and racism take time, take courage, take intellectual application by everyone. But let me just say, Stephen, moving finally from relations based on mistrust and defence to those rooted in mutual recognition and trust is the essence of reconciliation. Three things that I believe personally implicitly. One, indifference and inaction are not options. Two, separate but equal is not acceptable. Three, parallel living is simply not an option. I believe, as does the government, in shared future, that the people of Northern Ireland deserve much more. It was John F. Kennedy who said, "One person can make a difference, and every person must try." And I believe we must all try. We've done research. We know what the issues are. We now need to build the policy framework within that. We need to learn the lessons from elsewhere, as we've done. In closing, I'm reminded of a quote from Vaclav Havel. He said, "Work for something because it is good, not because it stands a chance to succeed." I believe that working to a shared future is good, and ultimately, with the input from all of us concerned, will succeed. Thank you.
And thanks very much, Nigel. And certainly Nigel is at the heart of government with responsibility for this policy, and I know he takes a very strong personal interest in this issue and sees it as the core of all types of governance in Northern Ireland at all levels. We now have about 30 minutes for questions from the floor, and again we have our two roving mics. And again, if you want to speak, please state your name and any affiliation, just for the formal record. There was a question from Dennis Dalton on the floor that Mitchell Rees very kindly batted on to Duncan. Do you want to pick that one up about the contradictions in the agreement, Duncan?
I suppose that the designation issue at its core was an attempt to try to ensure proper representation of everybody. And it's one of the issues which certainly has to be on the table. How do you ensure that under a guise of not measuring that real cooperation takes place, or under a guise of measuring, that it doesn't preclude us moving past that point. It's not for the Community Relations Council, I have to say, at this point, to say which is the right thing to do. It strikes me that the issue, though, of designation can only be justified within a context of trying to lever greater cooperation and greater sharing, rather than as a mechanism to stop it. And if it starts to function as a mechanism to stop it, we need to start to see if we can achieve it by other ends. So I don't think the Assembly is ultimately sat long enough to define that issue, but I do think that it needs to be a question that it is submitted, that whatever institutional structure we come up with is submitted to this test of, is it promoting a shared future? I suppose ultimately my case would be that no structure whatsoever will succeed unless underlyingly it's a sea change in what we think we're about, in which we regard each other as partners rather than as enemies. And so that shared future emphasis for me overarches that very important political question, and that it can, but the designation issue must be resolved, would be removed from me only because it clearly is not promoting a shared future, rather than because it's good or bad per se.
Okay, well, question here.
Thank you very much. Wolfgang Danzig-Gruber, Liechtenstein Institute, Princeton University. I come here to here as a layman, but on the Irish issue, but I really would like to say that thank you very much for putting this meeting together. It is an eye-opener for any interested observer of mixed relations, to refer to the outstanding speech on the educational situation. I would like to raise an issue which has nothing to do with Woodrow Wilson in this respect, but perhaps with some of its effects, his effects, or the effects of his politics, or his ideas. And that is, to which degree could the Northern Ireland situation benefit from experiences on a continent which is not too far away from it, which is also called Europe, of which actually it is part, and where from Monet and Schumann onwards, thinkers, practitioners, business people, teachers, politicians, doctors, and others have had to deal with situations where in certain small geographical areas people would insist to define their family, their part of their village, as absolutely theirs. I happen to know Switzerland very well. I don't need to explain to you that Switzerland suffered some of the bloodiest wars in its history, conducted by Swiss. I wrote my dissertation many years ago about foreign and security policy of the neutral states in Europe. I did not deal with this one country where, from the strategic perspective of the Cold War, you had the feeling the country really could do whatever it wants because it has such a fortunate geostrategic position about which the Finns would only grasp and do whatever to be able to exchange it.
Okay.
I dare to venture, as somebody who has studied Bolzano and the South Tyrolean issue and Catalonia in depth, that would that part of the world be somewhere else, much would be very different also today. So having said all this and referring back to the brilliant exposés, beginning by Duncan and then talked about, as you presented the educational element and as you, sir, presented the element of the from the perspective of the public service. I wonder, Northern Ireland has several situations now really going for itself. Number one, you are becoming, apparently, an employee importing society, which can, as Sir, you rightly presented, can be both an R2 as well as a challenge. Number two, we have an intense situation of globalization. And number three, we have something which was mentioned in part, which can be both beneficial, but it can also be detrimental, as the Chinese would say right away. Okay. You have the internet. And who is the most important consumer of internet? The generation between 10 and 25. So my question is, what out of these three issues, globalization, internet, and the EU, where could you see that you would right away, and since we live here in this society of 25 seconds, where you could see right away new elements which could be used to a beneficial development in the immediate future of Northern Ireland.
Okay, thanks. So who wants to pick that one up?
All three.
such a hugely complicated question that we can only kind of scratch the surface. Maybe we can talk about it later. I suppose that all of them are playing their part in the sense that we're here having this conference now for a start off in this global world. And also, I think the security issues that are happening even further away from here than they are from me in Iran and Iraq are the dominant issues. So we're now in a situation where this notion of us being islands doesn't exist. The globalization issue is massively important if it's true, and I'm only taking what literally are, that if you take it unofficially, not the official register, the unofficial register, if that's really true, the 750,000 people of foreign extraction are now living in the Irish Republic. It is transforming the nature of Ireland and therefore transforming the nature of what Ireland means, both to nationalists and to unionists, actually. So all sorts of things are happening there. Number two, the nature of the United Kingdom and its role in the world are shifting. It may in the end be that the decisive issue for Northern Ireland would be if the United Kingdom broke up through Scotland, not through us. There's all sorts of issues there. I think on the European Union side, European Union, for my money, has played overwhelmingly a positive role in Northern Ireland in the sense of creating the notion of common interest between Britain and Ireland, for me. However, it is thinkable that were the EU itself to go into some kind of crisis in which Britain took one side and Ireland took the other side, we would find ourselves stretching like this again over that. That's thinkable. All of these things are complicated matters. What you're certainly pointing to, which I think is important, is it's not just what happens locally which matters. Some of the shared future agenda is critical for us. And the final thing is the economics of this. The bottom line is modern economies which survive are modern economies which attract labour. That's the ones which are winning. That's how you know which ones are up and which ones are down, is who's going where. And the reality is that diversity as an issue now is either, the only question is it going to happen in our place, in our home, because it is an attractive place to come to, or is it going to be a question of us continuing to export, as Ireland has done for centuries, people across the globe into places where they're part of the diversity somewhere else. But one way or another, we have to get our children ready for a future in which this diversity is absolute reality now and not contested.
Okay. Nigel?
Three quick comments. I mean, I think the globalization one is fascinating. We all look at globalization, particularly, for example, the Indian-China issues around the movement of manufacturing facilities to India and China. But the figure that really frightened me recently was to hear that last year China had 2 million graduates in science, technology and IT. And that actually is the big challenge, because if, for example, on the island of Ireland and in Northern Ireland, we're looking for value added in terms of the economic issues, and Duncan's absolutely right, and we're going for the top end of the market, then very soon that will be the challenge as well. And another area of concern to me is, notwithstanding the fact that our economy is being driven by the incoming workers, if we begin to see service sector jobs being sucked out and going as well, then clearly the economic situation in Northern Ireland, which is actually quite good at the moment in terms of levels of unemployment, is fragile, and that in itself could add to the pressures. We do, I think we have something very significant going for us in terms of internet. We have 100% broadband penetration in Northern Ireland and a very high take-up. And we also, through our throughout our whole school system, we have every classroom and every school connected with connectivity to the internet, which is not only good in terms of administration and teaching, but very good in terms of teaching children individual IT skills. And that's actually a major boon that we need to build on. Because thirdly, you know, with an expanded EU, there are both challenges and opportunities. We've now seen huge movements, both not only in labour, but in goods and capital, east-west, west-east. And we've seen it on the island of Ireland. And the interesting thing, of course, is that we have an increasingly all-island labour market in terms of people moving north and south, who've gone south, coming back north again. So those dynamics are at play in a society which still shows the underlying symptoms that we've been describing this afternoon.
Okay, John Coakley in the middle here.
Thanks. John Coakley, Woodrow Wilson Centre and University College Dublin. My question is about the great difficulty that the Northern Ireland education system has had in integrating Catholic and Protestant schools. This is ironic given the fact that the elementary school system in Northern Ireland, like that in the Republic, was inherited from one of Peter Hain's predecessors, Chief Secretary Stanley, who in 1831 established a system that was intended explicitly to be integrated. Schools could only open under this system if they were attended by both Catholics and Protestants. And this legacy lasted well into the 20th century, in theory, though not, of course, in practice. So my question is this. Given this kind of historical heritage, and given the public policy importance of encouraging collaboration between communities and integrated education, why has the system been so resistant in practice, in both parts of the island, in fact, but my question is about Northern Ireland, to integrated education, leaving aside, of course, the fact that there are strong vested interests, such as the Catholic Church on the one hand and Protestant interests on the other, in favour of this. The question still is, why has the government not been prepared to challenge this more energetically than appears to have been the case?
Okay, I think that's obviously one for Michael.
Systems are, in my view, don't resist things, people do. The systems, people create systems and systems are very fluid to deal with things, but ultimately it's around people and leadership and policy. And I'm not trying to avoid your question. 1831, they set up a national school system. It worked for 10 years. Until politicians and church leaders in the main said, we would prefer to have Catholics and Protestants educated apart. Lord Londonderry tried it in 1921 as well, and it didn't work. And it was only in the 1970s when a group of Catholic and Protestant parents got a bill sponsored by Lord Dunleith that actually tried to change the system by allowing schools to change their status. And that didn't work until Brian Mawinney, who was the first Northern Ireland Minister of Education to come back under a direct rule government and brought in the Education Reform Order in 1989, that's how recent it is, saying there is a duty to, quote, encourage and facilitate. But that's not the same as actually promote. So in answer, Frank Wright, who wrote a book on integrated education some years ago, said if it ever became government policy, we may all pack up and go home. Because what he was actually saying is the drive for integrated education is the passion of parents who want to have their children put together. It was the parents who set up Lagan College and ran it for 4 years without government funding. It was parents who were, by some of their church leaders, denied Holy Communion because they were trying to bring their kids together with Protestants, who had placards outside the opening of Lagan College in 1981. These were prime movers, unsung heroes, in the education system of Northern Ireland. It still remains the case that it is driven by parents today. Now, what I would not want is that every school becomes integrated. I don't want a government policy that, in a sense, socially engineers every child into something, because we've got to get a balance between parental demand and policy that looks at how we can actually live together in the island and how we can balance that with parental choice. Parental choice and parental demand are not necessarily the same thing. The 50,000 spare places are in segregated schools today because of our dropping role. So at the moment, how can we say everything that parents want can be met? I don't think we can say that. But what we can say is, if what is at the top of the agenda is sharing this island together and having shared space, at least parents should have the right to have schools in which that happens. That is not currently the case. And I would like to see that the drive that parents are bringing together and parent involvement in integrated schools, I do not want, nor does our sector want, every school to be integrated. We don't want existing schools to desegregate. What we do want is much more sharing and collaboration. IT opens up for that, by the way. We can have virtual classrooms. It's happening. We have one excellent example happening up in Limavady, where a Protestant and Catholic college and a grammar school and an FE college are creating something that has never been seen before. It is not a formally integrated experiment, and yet children are exchanging lessons, they're exchanging experiences, and it would never have happened except for the drive of, in that case, the leaders of the school. It takes strong leadership. So in short, I think there has never been the pressure that has been brought to bear on government, I have to say, to do other than encourage and facilitate. And what that has left to is that parents demand it. The problem at the minute is the last four parent groups that came up and said we like schools were turned down last week because there are 50,000 spare places. I find that an illogical thing. I can't work that out myself at all. So I don't think there's an active policy to dissuade parents from doing it or to discourage integration. But what I would like to see is, why don't we do an audit of all parents in Northern Ireland and ask them, what type of school would you like? Why don't we do community audits in areas and say, how would you like your sharing to happen? Why don't we say to schools, rather than close, why don't Protestant and Catholic small schools in small areas come together? There are 500 schools in the north, less than 100 children. That is nonsense. It should not be happening in a mature society. So I'm suggesting there are ways that we can actually do this, but I think that the government must take stronger leadership and more courageous leadership to drive this.
Okay, anyone else want to pick up on that one?
Well, just, I mean, John, historically, I think the disastrous polarisation which British governments wanted, didn't want to happen, was a head-to-head confrontation with the Catholic Church. I think it was a historically seen as Britain driving something over the heads of a part of the population. I think one of the opportunities that is now there is a recognition on all sides that there are opportunities for collaboration which are now practically in everybody's interest. And one of the chinks, as Michael was saying there, is the choice now is close one of your schools and bust your children out. If there's two in a village which are non-sustainable, but they'd be sustainable if they amalgamate, close one of your schools and bust the children out, or let them stay in the village and let them work together. And I think that the opportunities, particularly in the west and the south of Northern Ireland, for that are actually quite promising. So what I am very keen, though, is that a shared future is read into the education reform very explicitly, so that this is actually encouraged rather than left as something could happen as a matter of chance.
Okay. Margaret Smith.
I'm Margaret Smith. I teach international peacemaking and conflict resolution at American University. There are a number of us here, and I include myself in that, but several others who've spoken who've had some involvement in programs in Northern Ireland with young people, especially trying to do cross-community work of various kinds. One thing that I've noticed on my recent visits to Northern Ireland is that a number of these organizations are actually concentrating more on single community work rather than cross-community work. And that perhaps is a symptom of something else that stands behind what some of you have been saying this afternoon, which is that it has been... Perhaps there's a phenomenon that's been developing recently where people who've been working towards this shared future have suddenly realized just how difficult it is and are sort of taking a step backward again. I don't know if that's what stands behind what you're saying, but I wonder if it is. But my question is, what is your learning at this point about what can be done at the grassroots level to help people recognize the possibilities of a shared future with their neighbors, with the people they're running into every day? How can the NGO community, the non-government folks, work with you on the aims that you're articulating in this program in ways that we perhaps haven't done so well in the past?
Okay, Duncan?
Well, actually, there's some good news stories in all of this, paradoxically underlying it, and the real question is how this reads across into macro change. That's really the question now. How do we get this into macro change? There is no doubt whatsoever, actually, in spite of all, the biggest segregating, the biggest change in favour of segregation is residential, particularly in working class communities. But every other indicator actually controlled by the public space is moving in the other direction. The workplaces are more integrated than ever before. The number of mixed marriages, as we call them, intercommunity relationships, is higher than ever before. The number of, in fact, while we talked about the integrated education, there's never been more pupils educated in similar schools in Northern Ireland's history. We come with an extremely segregated background in our, against which to operate here. The number of partnerships which have been established, and I think here things like the International Fund for Ireland and the EU Peace Programme have been particularly significant here. I took a group of visitors around recently from Scotland, and the normality around working on community development level with people across the community is unbelievable. I want to counter the notion that it's not actually in the heartland areas. I mean, there is absolutely tons of this happening on the interface. The really profound question is, nevertheless, people will do this pragmatically but aren't yet prepared to make the leap on the larger level, and it hasn't become systemic and it hasn't become common sense as normal yet. It's still commentable. My argument would be not that... In fact, if you take Community Relations Council, when the Community Relations Council began and I looked at my predecessor's stuff, the level, quality, content of the work that was being done, the level of conversations was incredibly tentative. It was just about good enough to get some people in the room. There were a very few organisations willing to do it. We now have literally thousands of organisations who see this as their business. The next leap, though, is, are we prepared to make this the dynamic force of this society, the direction? Policing is another example. I mean, we now do have a more integrated police service than ever before. We still have huge problems around policing, but if you're talking about progressive things, these are all progressive things. I simply would say to you that as we get closer to the choice existentially whether we're going to go in this direction or not, it actually simultaneously gets up the fears and all the issues are coming up. And the critical question now is, how do we resolve them? Are we ready to resolve them, or are we going to step back again? And my hope is that a dynamic comes now into the system which says, no, we have to move through these fears and through these issues now at a systemic level, in planning, in housing, in education, in local government, in all of these questions, and that's what a shared future is actually about, making this kind of, getting it from the small individual scale up into something which is now normality.
Michael or Nigel?
Can I just say something very briefly? Something that comes back from me talking to folk, particularly from working class unionist areas, is what they're now calling poverty of aspiration, which is actually then people don't believe they can do it. People have come to the sense of, well, how can we actually break through this barrier? It's a bit like in Narnia, whenever the walls were removed, people still didn't move because they saw the walls in their minds. And it's the mindset that says, it's always been so, it always will be so. And it's about strong community leadership, capacity building, it's role modelling, it's government intervention, it's not parachute dropping, it's building up from the bottom up. It's building up good capacity in those communities. And at the minute, money has been given to loyalist and unionist areas to try to build up some of that capacity. Because for a long time, if you think of the Shankill, where I have many friends, and you think of the very high levels of young people leaving school, for example, without any qualifications at all, and less than 5% of them are getting to grammar school every year for the last 3 years. Now, there's an educational problem in there. So this poverty of aspiration is real as well as imagined. And unless and until that is actually dealt with alongside the community, if you like, cross-community stuff, single identity work is and will continue to be extremely important, but it cannot and should not be an end in itself. It needs to be looking at how we can share with others, and unless it's asking itself the questions, what is it we're going to share, who is it we're going to share with, and what are the rules of that engagement about sharing? Because that's what we've got to move even the single identity work to.
Okay. Nigel, any thoughts? Okay, happy. I think we have one final question here, two final questions. Maybe we take those two final questions together, and maybe the panel can maybe respond to both collectively. So, first of all, yourself.
Hi, my name is Molly Hurley-Dupre. I'm from the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And the question I wanted to ask is in relation to the new immigrants who are moving to Ireland, to Northern Ireland in particular, or the North of Ireland. And how might this be affecting kind of the definition of community, for instance, in the case of Duncan here? And then in the case of education, where do they fit into integrated education where, you know, obviously the paradigm of what integration and of what community means really has to transform in that case. So I was just interested in in your ideas about that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And a final question at the back.
Yep. Patrick Tewitt, Drama Department, Catholic University. I'll be very quick. You had spoken about if you can't achieve integrated schools quickly, to hope for, look for opportunities for an integrated experience. And I wanted to offer a case study, a question within a case study, a shared space. How do people imagine or reimagine spaces in which they've inhabited for so long that really do divide or represent communities as divided? And the case study would be Martin Edwards and his murals on Bond Street in Derry. What would you do with them? And what would you do, say, would you support Tom Kelly with the Bogside artists? How would you play that out and the way that they conceive experience and whether or not that's an integrated experience.
Okay, a final word for each of our panelists. Duncan?
There's a very interesting document produced by the City of Stockholm about what this word integrated means. An integer in maths is a whole number. It doesn't ask that everybody's the same. It simply says that we have a sense of belonging to something, to a whole, and that we contribute from within that whole. Now, in that sense of the word integrated, and I'm answering your question first, there is a enormous role still for art and the reinterpretation of public space and the use of it, and particularly of symbolism, and the whole question that is in the end still begged actually in Northern Ireland of how we begin to create the notion of what a shared space looks like. There are a number of initiatives on this, a number of key ones for me. One of which is the Arts Council is going to run something called Art in Contested Societies, where they try to actually put high quality pieces of work to replace murals, and they're actually going to work alongside that. That's going to start sometime in the autumn with the Housing Executive, in the spring with the Housing Executive. The second one that I think is really important is in city centres, arterial routes, the places which are common spaces. And in institutions. I honestly believe that there's a big policy debate going on called the Review of Public Administration, which is trying to create a more efficient and effective public administration for Northern Ireland. For my money, the question of how institutions remain open and giving them a mandate to keep city centres, public spaces and arterial routes open is going to be critical, and that's going to also affect, and that needs to be done up front, because I think it'll be difficult for people to agree it after they get there. I think this conversation needs to happen for local government. So I suppose I'm saying to you, there are lots of things you can do with art and public, and actually quite good examples of some things which have happened recently. Even in places like Portadown, where George Best, the footballer, now replaces Billy Wright, who was a leading paramilitary figure. You know, C.S. Lewis on that side. On the other side, there's a whole series of international allusions and things which have been used in things. So that's true. Finally, your question about migrants. Up until now, most of our migrants have been young people of working age in Northern Ireland. And they haven't yet impacted on the school system. They haven't yet hit into the social system in the same way, and they haven't stayed while being unemployed. So we haven't had the same. Furthermore, in the Irish Republic, even on the official figures now. I mean, the paradox is Ireland now has the largest out-of-country Eastern European population in the most Western European countries, bar Iceland, I suppose, because it's had an open labour market and a massively growing economy. 11,000 people per month are getting what we call national insurance numbers, or what you would call social security cards, and there's been no increase in unemployment. No increase whatsoever. So up till now, we haven't hit, in many ways, this gunk. What we know, though, is that if this becomes more than simply temporary, if people put down roots, as people marry, as people have children, it will undoubtedly happen. And I'll give you two examples. And they're still one from the north and one from the south. The one from the north is that the biggest growth in the Catholic Church in East Belfast is Polish. because they're all going now, and there was recently a big racist attack on a Catholic church in East Belfast because of 300 Filipino nurses who are working in and worshiping in that community. So that's creating a thing. The other one is the Catholic population of the Irish Republic proportionately fell for the first time since 1931 in the 2000 census, and it's overwhelming, or at least over half of it, is made up of people from Nigeria, people from Africa, people coming from countries where they're now and there are now more Muslims than Methodists. So the reality is that we have this is a coming problem. It's hit some parts of the Irish Republic where there are intergenerational things. It hasn't hit Northern Ireland in large numbers yet, and it certainly will.
Okay, Michael, Nigel first.
Can I just follow up on the migrant workers? Yep. I mean, this is an issue unfolding actually before our very eyes, because in the year 2000, we didn't have any. We had traditional folk in the hospitality industry, but we didn't have this at all. Duncan's absolutely right, because what we are now beginning to see are folk who are coming with families, and that means that, for example, all the public services, I mean, I visit our offices and ask the folk in the offices, what's the single biggest problem you have? And they say, language, we don't understand, you know. So there's a major impact on public services. But if you actually look behind the public service issues and the public policy issues, it's very, very interesting to observe how a situation where you had two communities in conflict now has, admittedly a much smaller, but now has a third dimension brought into that, which affects the whole dynamic. Sadly, around some parts of Belfast, it has exposed racism, although there are strategies in place to deal with that. But this whole new dimension over the last 5 years is beginning to change the dynamic in terms of relationships between communities. And it's fascinating for those who have an interest in the community and are also considering the public policy implications of it. Sorry, Michael.
Okay, Michael, the final word.
Patrick, very briefly, and then very briefly, Molly. In terms of shared spaces, what we often do for visitors is bring them along to some of the integrated schools, and there are mothers and fathers sitting around a table, Protestants and Catholics, making decisions around the employment of teachers. There's nothing puts it in such a context as the reality of making decisions over whether you employ, hire or fire teachers, what your curriculum's going to be, what the school's going to look like. Some of the biggest problems we have over the school uniform and what the badge is going to be, the colours that they're going to be on it, is it going to be green or orange? Those are real issues that parents have never had the opportunity to engage with the other community. Shared spaces are there, and sometimes you've got to let people see the exemplars. Molly, in terms of your other, my big issue at the minute is we designate integrated schools are schools likely to be attracted by Protestants and Catholics at law. I think that law needs to be changed, because there are schools in Northern Ireland could never be integrated because 30% are actually not Protestants or Catholics, and at law they couldn't be so. Now, at the minute, most of our incomers are actually not other than the two Christian traditions. This is the bizarre thing. So we have schools where you have Chinese Christians from Hong Kong, you have Portuguese Christians, you have Lutherans from Latvia, and they're all sitting being added to Protestants and Catholics, and they were never what was envisaged by Protestants and Catholics. When we go to one of the number of schools we've got where there is a large security force contingent, oh, they're not Protestants, they're Brits. And the number of children would say, well, you've got Protestants, Catholic and British. Now, this is the reality in some of these schools. So we've got to look at a new way of doing identity. We've got to look at a new way of badging the children. And what we're trying to say, in a truly integrated society, there should be a majority which should never exceed, ever, 70%. And a minority which should be 30% minimum, and ideally 40%. Because when people get less than 30%, the heads go down. And they begin not to raise and talk about the other. And our experience seems to show that somewhere around 30%. So we would like the law changed that says 70% maximum of the majority and 30. And I think that's one way. Get also people from ethnic backgrounds on the boards of governors. It's happening. And many of the Chinese women in Northern Ireland bring their children along to the doctor to interpret for them because they don't speak English. Now, how do we begin to engage in an education system when one in two of the parents actually don't speak the language? So there's a huge issue there, not just for education, but for the extended school. And one of the things schools are now successfully doing is opening from 8 in the morning to 8 at night, engaging with English as a foreign language classes. They're trying to engage with families, showing that schools are more than schools. They're actually learning communities, and I think that's the way ahead.
Okay, thank you very much. And clearly there's a long way to go in this process of building a shared future. But I think certainly from what the speakers have said today that a good start has been made. And certainly it's my hope that the process and discussions currently underway in Northern Ireland can be of use for other situations around the world wrestling with similar problems. We have taken down a list of names of those registered, and we will ensure that any subsequent publications on this issue will be sent out to you by email. And hopefully you look forward to reading those in the future. First of all, can I thank the members of staff in USIP who helped with the organisation of this event today. Jennifer Haig, my research assistant, John Christ, my project manager, Erin Quimba, Carla and Shira. Without their help, we couldn't have had this today. Also, on your behalf, can I thank all of the speakers today, Mitchell Rees, who unfortunately had to leave, Duncan Morrow, Michael Wardlow, and Nigel Hamilton. And hopefully you enjoy the rest of the events of St. Patrick's Week. So thanks very much for coming along, and hopefully we'll see you at a USIP event in the very near future. Okay, thanks.